Question is, some days ago you spoke about impersonal consciousness. Can you please tell us something more about it? Thank you. It's a very good question. Because the consciousness, as you investigate the five khandhas, the five aggregates, rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, vijnana, then these are all impersonal, they're not self. But the one that create a sense of self is the sanya, sankhara, vedana, sanya, sankhara khandhas. It's the thinking, feeling, perceptual abilities of our minds, that we create a person out of it all. The body is just what it is. It's like, you know, we don't think of this as me, this lily. We don't think of it that I'm this lily, because it is a feeling of being separate from me. I can see it as something very separate. But the body, because of that, we're kind of being born into a body, we tend to see it very much as ourselves. And every culture, every civilization, of course, speaks in those ways. It assumes that we are the body. And consciousness also is a function that comes through being born. It's the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind itself, the mental, being the ability to be conscious of things, to bring into consciousness. So consciousness, say, when you're rupa and vijnana, they're in their pure forms. There's no, they don't, the consciousness is just function that goes on in the body, through the body. And then when you're conscious of something, say, you bring this into consciousness, say, eye consciousness, there's just the eye contact with this. Then to make it into something, you have to perceive it. You feel it, maybe, like you say you're attracted or repelled, this is mostly kind of indifferent. One is not particularly attracted or repelled by this, but then we perceive it as strikes the bell. And so that's a perception. And then we can, from that perception, if we like it, we don't like it, we'd like to maybe repaint it, or however we proliferate around it, and that is so that whatever language you would, you know, in each language you'd have a different word, but you perceive it as a bell striker, whatever, and so that, like, the Sanya Khanda gives it a name. It's a perceived as something. In pure consciousness, you aren't perceiving it yet, maybe, as anything. It's just what it is. And then you perceive it as something to strike the bell. And then say something more emotive, you know, like the flowers, the beautiful flowers, or maybe the lily here that's fading. It's getting all kind of wilted, and the consciousness, it's in your consciousness, eye consciousness, and then you feel maybe slightly averse to this, the feeling of being slightly put off by the wiltiness. And then one can, you know, create that. So the vedana, sanya, sankhara khandhas create this sense of me and mine. and it's attraction, repulsion, and volition, and all this that are carried on through those three. So when we talk about the suchness of something, then we're using that perception of suchness to remind or to bring into consciousness. It's just the way it is. It's not, we're not trying to perceive it as something. We're learning to be with the way things are. We're learning to say, open to the flow of conscious experience, rather than always kind of fixing things with perceptions and prejudices, likes and dislikes, and positions for or against. Or, say, the body, when you're it's the Veda and the Sannyasankara that make us feel, I'm this body. The body doesn't say that I'm the body. The body is just what it is. It's a condition in nature. And so we perceive it as this me, I'm this body. I'm a man, I'm a monk, I'm Ajahn Sumedho. And then although those perceptions will trigger off various proliferations, like I don't like the way I am, I like the way I am, I shouldn't be like this, I should be like that, and the whole kind of personality arises, comparing oneself with somebody else. That's the Vedana Sannyasankara operating. And it's in consciousness. But consciousness itself is neutral. It's just being able to recognize things. Like I, through through sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. Or through the mind itself. Being aware of the mood, the vibes, the atmosphere, the intuitive function of mind. Because like this is, look at yourself as, say, a sensitive form, not as a person anymore, a personality, which is fraught with our own conditioning, like being a man or woman. How many of you... You're really firmly convinced you are a man or a woman as a kind of permanent, ongoing thing. Isn't it? That's a very strong identity with the gender of the body. And then we assume that all the time the body is male and I'm a man all the time. Since the day I was born, or even before when I was in my mother's womb, in those days I didn't know what sex you were till you came out. Now they can tell. They can find out before it all happens. But in the old days, it was a big surprise. Was it a boy or a girl? And then the identity with gender is very strong. So that we think, or say, what do you think of you as a personality? So contemplate your own kind of, what you generally perceive yourself as being, a kind of person. And that perception probably, if you bring it into consciousness, and what you see, it's an underlying kind of thing in your mind. It's an assumption you make that you're the same person all the time. You're a man or woman all the time, the same person all the time. That's because of that, you make that assumption, because it's unquestioned. This is the way I am, I'm this kind of person, I'm a man all the time. I'm a monk all the time, or I'm a American all the time. Or, you know, these are fixed identities. But when questioned and investigated, you see they come and go in the mind. To become a monk, you have to... The perception of being a monk arises in your consciousness. Then you become a monk. and then it drops, and then that ceases. And so it's not that you think I'm not a monk anymore, but the perception of being a monk is no longer present, and that comes through certain conditions. Certain conditions will bring that perception up in our mind. The same with being male or female. I don't think any of us go around thinking, I'm a man, I'm a man, I'm a man, I'm a man, kind of obsessed with it. But then certain things in society come up, and then you say, I'm a man, or I'm a woman. And at that moment you become, when you perceive yourself as a feminine gender or masculine gender, then you become a man or a woman. This is just a way of reflecting. I'm not trying to tell you this is how it is, but this is a way of contemplating things that you assume, assumptions you're making about the kind of permanency of being a certain type of person, or a man or woman, or a permanent English person, or a permanent good or bad person, or lovable or unlovable, or whatever. We can get fixed in a perception of ourselves that we can carry on through a whole lifetime, that affects how we interpret life. But when you break through that basic conditioning and the assuming attitudes of your mind, you're more in the flow of your consciousness. You're with the changingness of this conditioned realm, in which then your relationship to it is in Dhamma rather than as a personality, as a good person or bad person, as a man or a woman, or a European or Asian or whatever. Then these things are still maybe conventions that we are appropriate to certain situations, but they're no longer personal identities, and they're no longer fixed assumptions that blind you and tend to distort the way you relate and interpret your life. It's like race or ethnic background, and how that, or class here in Britain, isn't it, where people are strongly identified with a class position. That one is underlying assumption, maybe I'm working class all the time. I was born into a working class family, and so since I was born, I'm working class forever till I die. Or middle class, or upper middle class, or lower middle class. In Britain, you have three kinds of middle class. In America, everybody's middle class. Working class is middle class. But here in Britain, these are identities. I notice, because I don't have that kind of perception. Class is not a particularly strong perception in my mind. Of belonging to any class. When you live in Britain, then you become aware of the cultural conditioning of that perspective. Like an American talking about the middle class is very different. We mean something different than when the British talk about it. So I remember one of the Anagarikas getting upset one time, because he's from working class, and felt very kind of committed and loyal to the working class, and I would make statements about, like, well, you know, we're all middle class, and he'd get very offended by that, because he didn't want to be put into that category. And this made a good point, isn't it, of how this you could get very upset over something like that. You know, so you want to leave. You think, well, I don't belong here. They're all middle class. I don't, and I'm working class. I don't belong here. and find a working class Buddhist organization. Then get into but those are the that's the misery we make, isn't it, over just those perceptions, because we assume we're, well, you know, those things have a reality, but it's dependent on the conditions, and so it's one is, you know, when the particular class subject of class comes up, then one is identifies maybe or is conventionally identified with a certain class, but it's only a perception. We're looking at it now in terms of Dhamma, of it's a perception in the mind that comes, that arises and ceases. And by doing this kind of reflection, you're breaking down this underlying assumption that you're permanent working class, or permanent female, or permanent good person or bad person. And also, you notice as you say in your meditation, as you are increasingly more mindful, as a mindfulness is more continuous, connected, then you're experiencing things that you have no perception for, and that we get confused when we can't perceive into something. That's when you get into doubt or some negative reaction, because you can't, because our reality for most people is through perceiving something as it's this or that. It's interesting to see when something comes into your consciousness you have no perception for, you tend to put it into a category that is nearest, you know, if it, or you tend to dismiss it, ignore it. So if you, I remember, just the cultural conditioning of like the Western musical scale, the octaves and that of the Western music, you perceive things in that you hear the sounds only in the designated notes, and the transitions are not noticed. We tend to, where say in say Indian music is much more like a dynamic form of sound. It's not so, and where sometimes we find, or Chinese opera, things like this, where we can even consider it cacophonous, or we can't, sometimes we feel at first, if you hear some Chinese music, it sounds so weird and strange that we just dismiss it. We can't even say it's not even music, it's noise. Because we're used to a certain, music is for us a certain thing that we hear. And when we hear something that doesn't align itself with that, then we tend to dismiss it. Or like learning a language, learning Thai language, which is a very different kind of language than a European language. It's a tonal language. And at first, I couldn't perceive the tones at all in Thai. They could say things like, you know, like, we were talking about this the other day. Ying is woman. Ying is a superlative. Ying is arrogant, and ying is to shoot. To shoot the superlative woman. And I'm sure most of you just heard ying, 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 didn't you? But actually, it was ying, ying, ying. And if you don't hear the, or, and ying, 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 ying. And these are the... And this makes all the difference in the meaning, you see. Where we would... Where in English, we're trained to perceive ying, the sound, the tone, we don't hear. It's we don't perceive it. We hear it, but we don't perceive it until we start perceiving it. Now, like when you're learning Thai, then because you can say some pretty ridiculous things, if you get the tone wrong, you have to train yourself to develop to listen to the tone, and that's quite a challenge I found is someone like myself to try to hear that, because at first all I heard was ying 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 ying, and then they'd say ying and I'd say ying, and then they'd say no and I'd say yes, I said ying. You get very frustrated. But that's because of the cultural condition, the language conditioning. You hear like learning another European language, like trying to learn French, because a lot of the sounds, French sounds, you don't hear. You can't produce in the exact way because the movements of the mouth and all that are, and the vowels we just don't designate. We don't perceive in as separate sounds, at least in my West Coast American accent. So that this was. You know, I found very frustrating trying to learn to speak a foreign language, because at first when you first started, you thought that everything was would be like the English language, and then one tended to, and then you learn oftentimes from books, so you perceive maybe a French word written in a book. Spelled in Latin alphabet, and then you pronounce it like you would in English. And of course, it's nobody understands what you're saying. So this is just what you know the conditioning. What we hear, what we perceive, tends to be conditioned, culturally conditioned. Now, in meditation, you're breaking through the cultural conditioning and the societal conditioning that we have. You're not trying to get rid of it, but you're getting to the original mind that's not conditioned through perceptions, so that you're getting in touch with that again, so that you're not just caught in this kind of dead reactiveness of conditioning. And that's why the Buddha would say people that are just conditioned are like dead. They're like they're dying all the time. He'd say apamado amatapadang. Mindfulness is the path to the deathless. Pamado machuno padang. And heedlessness is the way to death. Appamado namiyanti, mindfulness is like never dying, is like immortality, is non-death. Mindfulness is non-dying. Ye pamada ya tamada, and heedlessness is like dying all the time, the same as death. Each heedless moment is like a death. And so this is, contemplate that, you know, just how empty and meaningless life can get when we're just operating out of the conditioned reactions and how dreary life gets as you get older, as the perceptions get rutted in just mechanical consciousness, in mechanical reactions. You know, how our lives become just so meaningless and empty
and dead for us is we just live in a realm of conditioned reactions to life. And so in meditation, I think that's why we come to retreats like this, isn't it? Because of intuitively we're aware that life is now, and that maybe we've lost touch with it. We're caught in just this and bound into this reactive conditioning. And so this is where in the silence more and more you're getting even to before you were conditioned at all, like the pure consciousness that came at birth, and the mentality that wasn't perceptual yet, hadn't been influenced by perceptions of being a boy or a girl, or being working class or middle class, or being anything. And so as you move to that kind of stillness in your mind, begin to note that more, then you have the perspective on the condition, and you can begin to see just a lot of fear and insecurity, personal insecurity, and things like this. The subtle movements, they're not like kind of, you know, obvious problems, but just how through our lives we've reacted in this way over and over again. We're so used to it we don't even notice it. And then as you're more and more mindful, you begin to observe it. Begins to be, you're allowing it into consciousness. And then you can let it go. When you allow the subconscious things into consciousness, then you're letting them go. Then you can let go of them. So something like Alcoholics Anonymous, where they say that an alcoholic cannot be cured until he actually admits, says, "I'm an alcoholic." And so in that point, then that person is allowing, admitting into consciousness, "I'm an alcoholic." Maybe for the first time, he might have been drunk for years on end, but would never. But it was merely a reactiveness of life, and then that somebody says, "You're an alcoholic," and then me, "I'm not. I can stop anytime I want," or they can make jokes about it, be facetious, and say, "Yes, I'm an alcoholic, but that's a good thing," or make it into a good thing, but it's still not admitting, you know, like the truth of it. And then, when that is admitted, then something in you, then you can start letting go of it. You can, that's why it's like sometimes like being able to talk to somebody about how you actually feel. So that you can hear yourself telling somebody, a confidant, about all your fears and anxieties, and then by just telling somebody else, then sometimes you're actually allowing these into your consciousness, and you're listening. You're beginning to, and in that way, you're also letting them go. You can let them go. So that's why, say in helping each other, learning to listen to each other rather than to kind of give advice. Sometimes all that somebody needs is to listen, so that they can tell all their fears and worries, and in that way, sometimes they feel much better after that. Why is that? And it's, you know, I see it is working because you're allowing these fears and worries into consciousness. And that's why it's not very good to take it to, like, the one that's listening to. I mean, I've made many mistakes when people were doing this to me, to try to solve their problems and end up, you know, really not listening, but just, you know, saying things they already know. They be mindful and keep the sila and all that, and then but maybe they just need to be able to talk and say the things that they've never told anyone, so that they can hear themselves saying it. Because in that way, it's also a kind of releasing, and letting, you can let go. You can see what you're doing. Where oftentimes we're stuck in just denial or in ignoring. We develop defense mechanisms where we can not allow things to get into our consciousness. So that when anything starts, anything frightening or unwanted starts getting on the edges of our consciousness, we have defense mechanisms, ways of distracting ourselves, of getting away from it. And then, and so life can go on in just this kind of rip, and that's what alcoholism is, really, or these addictions. They're just ways of dealing with fear and ignorance, so that that's a way of kind of getting away from the fear. A habit that one develops. Say, but in meditation now, you invite the fears up and all the negative states and let them come when they're ready. You don't have to start making a big thing about it. But in meditation, sometimes anger can suddenly become very strong, and fear, being very frightened when there's nothing to be frightened of. And then to regard that in terms of Dhamma is to see what has arisen in your consciousness. You can let go. Remember that. What it is, if you let it into consciousness, you can let it go. So that consciousness is the door of liberation. The consciousness is a function. It's not you. So that's why we can still be conscious and still be very ignorant. And alcoholics are still conscious, and totally mad people are still conscious. I mean, it's not that their consciousness is not being informed, not being developed with wisdom. So in these Dhamma teachings, remember that these are wisdom teachings, therefore developing, for watching, for their tools to use. Not things to grasp, but tools to use. And the more we, as you say in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, as you say, Vedananupassana and Jitanupassana, then like the Jitanupassana, you begin to observe the kind of clinginess of the mind, the feeling of just feeling compulsive or attached, the mental state of the jitta or the mind. And you aren't perceiving it. You don't need to perceive it as a certain thing, or to judge it and some kind of, you know, some kind of moral judgment or value judgment about it. Just to note it. What we tend to do is we see attachment. We're attached to something, and then we think, I shouldn't be attached. If I were a good Buddhist, I wouldn't be attached. I'm attached to my cat. And if I were really practicing, I wouldn't be attached to the cat. And that's a That, notice the, that whole frame of reference. I am attached to my cat, and I'm a Buddhist, but I'm not very good because a good Buddhist is free from attachments. So if I were to free myself from the statement, I'd probably have to get rid of the cat. Then a moral dilemma is, but isn't that being selfish if I you know, think about the cat, you know, if I get rid of the cat might suffer. And therefore, maybe I'd better stay attached till a little longer. And the whole thing is based on the logic of I am this person who's attached to this thing. But if you're letting this into your consciousness, just listen to it. And listen it to this sense of this feeling of being attached to the cat. You know, this feeling of just to note it, not to judge it. But just to observe it, to look at that feeling of affection or attachment to the cat, and then to trust in just the attention on it, to not investigate it as just for what it is, without and see the tendency to maybe put a personal label onto it, like I am attached, and I shouldn't be attached. And my mic's detached. It takes a lot of, like when you don't like somebody, say for example, somebody you don't like, and then idealistically you think, well, you should have metta for. So it's one thing is that you feel this aversion to somebody, and then you come on with some kind of value judgment about it on a personal level, or you can say, well, the person is, you know, shouldn't be that way. But if you listen to that whole process, that's all you need to do, just to bear with it, to listen to the and to accept the feeling of it, of not liking. But notice that it's the perception of a person, not the person themselves. Because if you notice, you can think about somebody and not like them, but when you actually meet them and start talking to them, you start liking them. But then because liking is based on, you know, is a very dependent emotion. It's, you know, it depends on things. It's not like the perception. Somebody that's done you wrong, and then you remember them. Then you think they did that to me, and so then whenever you remember them, then you feel this aversion. So you can study that. You can think of somebody who's hurt you, who's done wrong to you, and then you. You see, it's really a perception in the mind. Perception, not a real person. It's a memory of a person, and that memory is connected with a perception, with a memory of some unpleasant thing that happened. So every time you think of that person, that same feeling comes, and then you find yourself maybe meeting on the street and suddenly forgetting all about it and start talking about something you both find interesting, and then you're talking in a friendly, jovial way again. And the perception of that person as being the person that's done you wrong in the past, for that moment, isn't there. And then you walk away, and then you start thinking about them again, and then they aren't all that bad. But then you can fall back into the old perception again, too. So, I mean, this is why. But this ability to witness and observe and listen is what we're pointing to trust in this more, and to use it. It's in investigating and examining the way things are.
So we want feeling loving kindness to okay, that gives us as a passing.
Well, loving, that's a skillful means, loving kindness. You see, so that loving kindness is a perception like anything else, but it is loving kindness is a perception, a unifying perception rather than a dividing one. The mind will work like we're all humans, we're all equal. Everyone is as good as everyone else. We can talk in perceptions of equality and freedom and totality. And that's one way of perceiving. Or we can shift and say, that person is a criminal, that one is a drug addict, that one is something else, and we start discriminating. And then we put them into perceptions that are separating them, and then we can get it even to personal feelings. I like this person. I don't like that person. And so that the mind, you see, can work in developing metta meditations more on the level of all sentient beings. May they be free from suffering, may they be happy, may they be well. It's all, and then we perceive all possibilities from the gods, the humans, the devils, the animal kingdom, the beings born and beings not yet born, in this way it's kind of using the mind to create this atmosphere in the mind, or the aramana of a universality, a oneness, non-discriminative. So metta is, you don't have metta more for this person. Metta is the same for everything. You know, because you're not thinking, I want 50% of my metta to go to my spiritual teachers and guides. I want 5% to go to the devil. That's ridiculous, isn't it? So you have, you know, it's just completely using language to bring in the sense of totality, of one universality. Then when we do the asupa, there's the asupa practices, which is a practice for monks especially who live celibate lives, where you're not allowed to have any kind of sexual activities, so that we instead of seeing everybody is all beautiful, which is one way, you know, but there's another way of training the mind of looking at the not beautiful, so that we tend to, you know, you go through the body, you see the organs of the body and the things that are not beautiful in yourself or in somebody else, and this helps to break down the illusion that which creates lust in the mind. Like if the lust depends on the illusion of that person being really beautiful and attractive, and then lust is a very blinding emotion. You know, you lose your discrimination when you get caught in the power of lust. Your discriminative faculties pack up; they don't work. So then to counterbalance that, you develop discriminative. It's like underneath this lovely skin is a skeleton, or inside there's urine and excrement, and there's and then you think of just the hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. These things which tend to we regard as glamorous in a lustful way, but when taken separately, we don't find them arousing lust, when just seen in their separate form. So this is a way of investigating discriminative abilities to counterbalance the power of lust, which is very blinding. And then the metta is a practice to an antidote to aversion and criticalness. Not liking this, not wanting that, hating and looking at, criticizing and fault-finding. And so these are just skillful means that we use that help you to, they're tools for investigation.
I had a question about the dying flower there. Is creativity considered proliferation of the mind? I noticed that Buddhist teachers that I've had are very skilled in metaphor and can be quite poetic about it. And I was thinking about seeing that flower as it is, but also that could inspire all kinds of thoughts about death and the meaning of death and the meaning of life. It's quite beautiful thoughts.
Right, because the creativity is a spontaneous thing from the mind. It's not the kind of from the dead conditioning of the mind. So when the mind is freed from the deadness of its conditioning, its reactiveness, then you find more poetic expressions or things speak to you in different ways, or you start noticing things that you didn't notice. Like if you're just conditioned, you tend to have, you just fixed, you see everything in just a very fixed way. And then like the artist tends to work more on the intuitive, so that the fixity of, like the average, say, person's way of looking and perceiving life, the artist tends to challenge, oftentimes it challenges that. If it's real creativity rather than just cleverness. Because even the decaying process has its own kind of beauty or marvel. But if you're looking at If your perception of beauty is this, the lily at its kind of peak, flawless, and then you look at this, then you I don't like this. You think
in terms of how it would look on the dining room table.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you're comparing it to this. Yeah. And this is what you see as beautiful, then this is not, you see. Because your mind is fixed on this is a beautiful one, and this one isn't. That's how you perceive it. But if you drop all that, then you begin to, then the mind will respond to the way it is, and you start looking at it not as in a fixed way of as beauty as being only the peak of something, only the best. Well, the asupa deals more with the gamma realm, gamma dhanha, or sensual desire, desire for sense pleasure and sense excitement or stimulation, and then the other is more like bhava dhanha, the desire for becoming, like
desire for refinements and bliss and the bhava dhanha is vipava dhanha, the desire to get rid of things. These are subtler kind of desires, but the same. So but in reflecting on, like, noting happiness, one is say, when you're investigating, say, the bhava dhanha, a desire for to attain something good, not just some kind of selfish desire to have a blissful life for yourself, but even, you know, a desire for everyone to be happy, and how the suffering that comes from that. Or you can see mothers suffering a lot over their desire that their children be happy and not suffer. And the anguish of motherhood when they, because of the desire that to see their children happy and successful. And that's a, like a bhava dhanha, or desire to get rid of their, take away your children's suffering, to get rid of it. But all of it takes you to the grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish. Like if you're attached to happiness, happiness is still happiness, but the attachment to it will take you to grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish. So like people that want happiness all the time, get a lot of despair because they keep trying to hold on to things, and then what makes you happy now may not make you happy tomorrow. And so you keep having to find new ways of becoming happy. Or in meditation, we want to become, we want to get the advancements or feel we're getting someplace or these kind of bhava dhanha. Or we're trying to get rid of the defilements, self-hatred, hating ourselves for having a wandering mind, hating the wandering mind, hating the doubtingness, hating the inner kind of incessant chattering. All of this is vipava dhanha. So when we're trying to shut up, make our mind shut up and get rid of our bad thoughts and trying to become somebody, then the meditation, no matter how we try, it ends up taking us to grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish. So this is why the three kinds of desire are to be let go of, the letting go of desire. But to let go of desire, you need to know what it is. You can't just let go of desire theoretically. So you need to study desire. So, and this is really important, rather than come from the thing, I shouldn't have any desires, or good Buddhists shouldn't have any desires. Whatever desires you have, really, really look at them. Really feel them. And, exaggerate them. Bring them so that you're really, really, you can really look at them and see and feel them. And then you begin to your intuition will then start revealing their true nature. But if you're merely coming from a kind of rejection, I'm with a desire now, I shouldn't, and try to suppress, then that's vipava dhanha, and then one's always kind of running away from things, thinking that that's the right thing to do.
What's the witnessing ability in terms of sundown?
Well, that, the refuge is in the in Buddha, you see. So this is in intuitive awareness, and so it and it operates through consciousness. But it's transcending consciousness. But it's affecting consciousness. Because like Buddha is universal intelligence, deathless. And so your refuge is in the deathless rather than in the consciousness is a result of birth, the separate form. Consciousness always implies subject-object. So, like, there's the relationship of the subject to the object. That's why in we're all, you know, being in a separate form, being born as a separate entity, then consciousness operates in this way. We are the subject, you are the object. I'm the subject, you're the object. Now I can interpret that on a personal level, like I'm Ajahn Sumedho, you're Philip. And we can talk about it in terms of conventional reality, of how the world sees it all and how we're conditioned to perceive our relationship as two people, two persons. But in terms of Dhamma, what's actually taking place is that you're in my consciousness. When I look at you, you're in a consciousness now here. That's what's actually taking place, as far as in my experience at this moment. So you're an object of my sight, and then I have a perception of you as Philippe. See, so I perceive you as somebody I know, and I have a name for you, But in actual experience, it's this: you're an object in my consciousness, and there's a subjective knowing of it. Now I can interpret it in terms of worldly attitudes and conventions, or I start interpreting it into Dhamma. So in terms of Dhamma, rather than emphasizing personality and all the rest of it, we're putting it in the paradigm of the Buddha and the Dhamma, you see. So that the Buddha is the knowing, is the pure subjective knowing. But it, instead of being personal, it becomes it's universal. And then you as an object in consciousness is seen as Dhamma, rather. The aramana in the mind, a condition that arises and ceases. And when one also sees the perception of Philippe and all that as a kind of function of the mind, but it's putting it in terms of Dhamma, in which, of what it really is, rather than in terms of worldly values, which are, I'm Ajahn Sumedho, you're Philippe, and we're on this meditation retreat together, kind of the conventional realities is one thing, but then putting it into terms of what's actually taking place beyond the influence of cultural conditioning and personal conditioning into Buddha Dhamma. Then in relationship, then we relate to each other as Sangha. To practice together, support each other, and respect each other, and so forth, in terms of sangha, on the practical level of my refuge in sangha, then I relate to the objects around me with, say, sila. The other beings around, I relate to them through non-violence, through non-thieving, through restraint, through respecting their them in through metta.
In this question the other day, you mentioned about the Kali temple and sexuality being sacred in the Hindu tradition, you know, life is sacred. In the Hindu tradition, it's a bit of Brahman. Or even according to Buddhism, enlightenment is possible in the human form. So, life is I was only thinking about the Christian saying of being sinners out of desire we see beings are created full of suffering. So the word sinner sort of in the unskillful with desire to create a being which is subject to suffering.
Well, like what you can actually know is like you get certain kind of doctrines of different religions, and like the Christian tends to Jewish and Christian doctrine tends to come from we're born sinners, and through Adam and Eve who sinned, and then. And so that we're involved in that original sin, and this is a strong cultural perception of being a sinner, and it tends to be Adam and Eve tends to be placed in a period of time like in back in time. It's a historical event almost in the way we perceive it. They did Adam and Eve. Did something wrong way back when. And so ever since then, all the human beings that have been born sinners. Mm-hmm. Now that is a perception in the mind. You can know that. Isn't it? It's a mythological language. That kind of thinking is conditioned into us. It's perception. And this we can see the Dhamma of it. We may like it or not like it, and that's also Dhamma, to see liking that teaching or doubting it or having contempt for it. We can see all that as conditions that arise and cease and react to in reaction to that perception. But then say in Buddhism, it's interesting to compare, say, like most of us were brought up in Jewish or Christian societies, or societies that were that come from that kind of influence. So that one of the big problems that we have is guilt. We have tremendous guilt problems, and I've talked about this with Tanjokun Panyananda, because one time Tanjokun Panyananda, a Thai monk, was here, and somebody was asking him about guilt, and Tanjayasara, the British monk, was with him. He's very good in Thai, and he was translating, trying to explain in Thai what Western guilt is, and Tanjokun Panyananda couldn't quite see the problem there. And then he just said, yeah, well, that's just a minor mental agitation. And so he just said, and I said, for you maybe, but for us it's a kind of major, overwhelming mental agitation. And then asked him about how do Thai people see themselves as. Well, they don't see themselves as sinners, as a culture anyway. They see themselves basically pure, and then through their acts they make defilements, but their true nature is purity, you see. So, and this is both in Hinduism and Buddhism, the cultural assumption there is that you're pure,
And then through the karmic acts, you, but your true nature is pure, and it's still pure all the time, even though, but these wrong acts blind you, and you get lost in your own delusions. But in that way, then you don't find such overwhelming guilt problems. And the Dalai Lama was asked about how Tibetans see themselves, and he said, basically, Tibetans like themselves. And Thais, I think, basically like themselves. You know, they don't have the, but I think Westerners, we don't like ourselves. and you can, I'm sure it, you can trace it back to just the cultural assumption of sinning, of being sinners.
That's unfortunate, really, but when you look at it from the Dhamma point of view, in a way, sort of a desire giving rise to creating a being which is subject to suffering, looking at life in a different way. You have said this many times, less, I think, but the other day someone asked the Dalai Lama about the population of 2%, and he said, birth control is very good, and he said, contraception is very good, but the abortion is sad. And they said, I think more people should become monks and nuns. Less babies, and there'll be less violence also.
Yes, I'm doing my bit for population control.
One cannot actually say one is actually born pure, is one? Because one's actually born with karma. There is karma there from the moment one's conceived in the mother. Is there not? Is one not influenced by the stars, the moon, the personality of the parents, possibly what one's done karmically previously? So one's actually born with karma to work with, isn't one? One's not actually born with pure consciousness only.
Well, I mean, there's the underlying influence, karmic influences, but then these are like, this is what makes us get born anyway. But the mind is basically pure, and then these karmic things as they arise, as our karma rises, we're accepting it and letting it go, in just say in conscious experience. So in that letting go, then we're letting go and realizing the immortal reality, the true nature of the deathless reality. You see, so that these forms. So that the Buddha was teaching a way that because of our karma, I mean, we all have different things to work through, different problems in the myriad varieties. But the refuge is in the universal, not in the particulars. If there were no way out, then it would be a hell realm. But because there is this, no matter what our karma is, like in the scriptures, you had like Angulimala, kind of killer, become an arahant, and yet after he became an arahant, wherever he'd go, people say Angulimala, killer, and throw rocks at him and beat him up. And I'm sure that must have been very unpleasant for him, but. But he knew it was the resultant karma of having killed people. So as an arahant, he could accept the resultant karma without anger or resentment. So that's like we whatever we get in life, when we see it in terms of Dhamma, then it may be unpleasant or unfair, or whatever, but. But then we're recognizing that in terms of Buddha knowing the Dhamma rather than And so then we can bear with it, we can resolve it. Like Angulimala could resolve his karma through understanding, even though he couldn't get out of it.
By the sister's cave, there's a piece of cloth stretched between two poles. And I was wondering what the symbolism was behind that cave. The symbolism behind the cloth which is stretched between two poles by the cave.
Oh.
Just got off on hand then.
Oh, yes.
I thought it was to keep the wind off the flower.
What's it for?
Oh. No, it's fairly functional.
But I couldn't be sure.
Do you think we could take it down? Or?
Well, I think the wind is so huge at the moment. It looks like it's actually wind there. But I think it's a
great deal. I thought there's some very deep meaning. At first I thought it was one of the robes being hung up, and then I realised, no, it's not a robe.
Number four, can you say something about what happens to the mind in sleep, and whether there's some value in being mindful of your dreaming?
Well, I think as your mindfulness increases, then you tend to, like I find, that I don't need to sleep very much, and I fall asleep mindfully, so there's something still, even though you're unconscious, you're in sleep consciousness, you can get up at the right times and things like this. It's not like heedless. It's not like being crashed out into a heavy sleep, but it is a restful state of mind in which the body can rejuvenate its energies. And then dreams, how I see that is oftentimes they're the things that have been kind of ignored during the day. They come out in dream states at night. So that by observing, you know, you can see that certain things are maybe you need to look at things in a different way, or they can oftentimes give you kind of clues into point the things in your life that you are heedless of, or emotions that you still aren't accepting, or fears and that. And then there are the other kinds of kind of dreamlike states or visions that you can have. There's a very kind of clear and oftentimes you know, the people want these kind of dreams because they're very interesting. But they only come when you can't make them happen. They come when the time is right. But not to make anything out of those either, because the danger is always to try to complicate it with some kind of personal attachment. So some people, you know, really want to have these visionary kind of experiences, thinking that that's some kind of attainment. But that's the wrong attitude, you see, to take it on a personal basis. So like in Lungpa Cha was always saying, whatever it is, just see it as impermanent and not self. So if some people have visions and can, you know, have all kinds of fantastic kind of psychic experiences, and other people don't. Some people don't have anything very interesting But as far as Dhamma goes, it's not. It, one sees that whatever is subject to arising is subject to ceasing. So note that they, you're putting in the context of Dhamma, even if it's most kind of fantastic visions and marvelous kind of messages from the gods and whatever. Look at it in terms of its impermanent, rather than as, you know, special, I'm a special person. Or if you've got a mind where none of this is produced, you just sit there and get dull or nothing interesting ever happens. Dullness and boredom, and that also is impermanent and not self. So I mean, it's we're looking at it in terms of Dhamma rather than in terms of its quality. And this we have to trust in, because we're working out our karma. You know, it's people have different karmas to work out. But if you're going through a really dreary patch, nothing interesting, no end visions, no kind of blissful moments, just aching knees and sore back and dull mind, then you talk to somebody else and say, "Oh, what a fantastic meditation retreat!" And, God, you know. And, lights and then the marvelous kind of angelic creatures came and I really saw, you know, the truth that really, you know, Buddhism is it. And, wow. And then you think, oh, you know, I'm not getting anywhere. And if you just trust in being aware of whatever it is you're feeling, that's developing the path. It's very direct. Person that gets lost in the marvelous visions, they're not developing the path. Or the person that gets lost in their own despair, their inability to have anything more interesting, have any interesting experience, that they're not developing the path. But the developing the path is by seeing that whatever subject to arising is subject to ceasing, and is not self.
Mentioned the other day that one person's mindfulness is the same as another person's mindfulness. Can you say a bit more about that?
Well, it's like when you, if there's a pure awareness, that's a symbol of the island that you cannot go beyond. And then from there, you can see you're aware of the objects of the mind, like the thoughts or the feelings, perceptions, attachments, you know, the kind of, which are personal maybe. But that which is purely aware is non-personal. And so that it's not mine or it's not yours as on a personal level. Maybe there's the mindfulness there within the particular forms, but the it's the same. It's not like two. Because even though that's the way it looks in the conventional perception of it, yet the pure awareness is universal. It's not personal. And therefore, when you realize that, then the sense of loneliness is resolved, because one of the problems we have is with loneliness. We get very lonely, and as you get more introverted, oftentimes you get even more lonely, monastic life is incredible loneliness you have to go through. The sense of loneliness that comes through celibacy and through not being able to have things, very many things. And also the way you can be so isolated in your own practice. And then as you But then as you reflect more and realize the oneness, underlying oneness, then that feeling of being somebody who's alone or lonely, you see it only as a condition of the mind that drops away. It no longer has the power to influence you anymore. But in and you can see each one of us is alone, existentially speaking. And we can see that oftentimes our loneliness, all attempts to just have someone else to relate to is an attempt to get rid of the loneliness. And so we make demands on others, and thinking, you must relate to me so I won't feel lonely. And so you can see, like, people marrying each other with this demand of take away my loneliness. And in the process, sometimes they even feel more lonely. Or, sexual promiscuity, activities like that tend to make people more lonely, because even though there's more an attempt to kind of relate to somebody else in some physical way or some emotional way, it's based on it creates the sense of even more loneliness or alienation. So then when one is going through the meditation and you're investigating more and more, sometimes you feel even more lonely. But taken to that, to the island you cannot go beyond, then the loneliness dissolves, because you realize a universal, the oneness, and then you relate to people not through that kind of demand or need for emotional reactions from them, but then through compassion or respect and love and joy are the ways of relating, responding to each other from the purity of the mind. And it's universal, like metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha, the four Brahma Viharas are divine radiances. They're universals, they're not personal kind of qualities or karmic tendencies. They come through that relinquishment of delusion. And then we relate to each other. I mean, like, on a practical level. And it's interesting, when Ajahn Amaro went to Dharamsala last month and for this conference with the Dalai Lama, and he was saying that this woman, a nun, but she's an English person, but she's been a Tibetan nun for years, and she was telling the Dalai Lama about the conditions of the Tibetan nuns and how difficult it is to be a nun in the Tibetan tradition. And she went on for quite a while in a very kind of dramatic way, and the Dalai Lama was crying. I mean, they had to give him a box of tissues. I mean, obviously there's a sense of, was he lost in some kind of personal, grief over the state? Or is that a natural response to hearing such sad things? But there's no, it's a natural response. When we hear the sadness of something, we cry. But it's not personal. It's coming from the universal, from the compassionate universe. You see, then it's where when it becomes personal, then it then it becomes distorted in some way. And so like say in a country like this where we tend to suppress those tendencies to cry or to, when we hear sad things, we can just kind of turn off to them. We can, when we hear news about, like you're hearing the terrible news about children being murdered and things like this, and then it's sad, but we have ways of just kind of ignoring, of not feeling it, understanding it intellectually but not feeling it. But as you're more mindful, then you're willing to feel it too. You're willing to feel the sadness of life. And in that, it's not suffering anymore. It's not feeling the sadness of life isn't suffering. It's compassion. It's where we when we feel it, the compassion is there. We're willing to feel the suffering of the universe is karuna. Or we're willing to feel the beauty and joy of the universe is mudita. And upeka, the equanimity to be able to abide in. I mean, we're no longer seeking to feel compassion, or we're not caught in the desire to have compassion and mudita and joy and love. But much of life is equanimous, is neither, you know, one or the other, but equanimous, and which is very blissful, which is bliss or equanimity. I think we can have a sitting.